My guest today is Xiaolu Guo, here to discuss her new book, Radical, A Life of My Own. Like all of Xiaolu's work, Radical is difficult to describe because it's difficult to categorize. It might be called a memoir, but its form, that of a lexicon, a dictionary, of words and images, which sits somehow in the cracks between English and Chinese, makes it unlike any memoir readers have encountered before. It's also a fascinating reflection on language, on literature, on memory, on vagrancy, on art, on nature, and on what makes a home. But perhaps the central circle in this Venn diagram of concerns is love. Its different forms, how it arrives, what it does to us, and how it fares under imposed separation. Xiaolu Guo, welcome back to Shakespeare & Company.
Thank you.
As I said in the introduction, this is a difficult book to to talk about because it goes in so many directions. And really, I would probably just say to our listeners, get the book and read it rather than trying to sort of unpick what the book is like from my description of it. But could you just talk a little bit to begin with about how you arrived at this form of the book, this lexicon? Because was it the form that shaped the content? Was it the content that shaped the form? Or was it a sort of back and forth process between the two?
I think you got the right opening question, because the form actually took over in the very beginning. And I wanted to write a private lexicon or etymology of separations, layers of separation, but through a set of vocabulary. So the separation with my original language, Eastern language, Chinese language, and then separation with my native country, China, and my parents, you know, the people who died in my family, and also just culture, which, you know, it's very far away from me now, living in Britain. And then this book is set in New York. So it's a layer of separation, build this collection of vocabulary or lexicograph. And I wanted to write this private dictionary, in a way, to describe a womanhood with particular stress on set of words. For example, including some words very much about male identity, like Übermensch, you know, Nietzsche's concept. And then those words, for example, Germanic words, for example, Lebenskünstler, the living artist, the art of living, you know, as his living being. So those concepts, they're Germanic or Anglo-Saxon words, and then some French words. And I want this book contain mostly Anglophone words, but some French, some Germanic, some Chinese words. And then the whole collection would sum up my personal experience in this layer of separation through language, through landscapes, through cultures.
You've used the word private twice, a private dictionary, a private lexicon. And that's one of the things I found so fascinating about this book, was the way it's clearly a collection of things which are meaningful to you and which speak to you. And yet through that, it seems to take on a sort of a general meaningfulness, I think, to the readers as well. Was that a difficult line for you to tread? So, for example, when you are talking about certain concepts or certain writers, to keep it to your private feelings, your private interpretations, your private responses to, for example, Walt Whitman, rather than trying to give a general theory or a general approach to these ideas?
I think we'll come back to my very idiotic attempt to somehow rewrite. You know, as a foreign author, you know, you often take some grand work, you know, the Western work, to think, well, if, you know, if I was an author, what would I do? For example, I had this very funny year just reading Dr. Samuel Johnson's dictionary, the English dictionary, which was such interesting, tough, in personal experience, to look at Dr. Johnson's kind of analysis and definition of just this vast amount of words, Anglo-Saxon words. And then when I was in New York that year doing the visiting professorship, I was looking at Webster's dictionary and how he treated American English dictionary as a sort of revolutionary attempt to be away from the colonial influence. And me there, you know, as a Chinese author using Anglophone language to write, and I had this obsessive fascination with language and the use of a dictionary, I thought, well, yes, you know, Dr. Johnson and Webster But they're both from this kind of Anglophone sphere to write. Mm-hmm. English tried to establish some kind of grand new identity, you know, from their time. But what about a new immigrant at my time? You know, it came from faraway culture, you know, East culture, with the cultures based on the ideograms, non-alphabetical grammar and language. How would we rewrite or kind of recreate a dictionary, you know, looking all like Anglo-Saxon words, but would we, you know, include a lot of kind of non-Anglo, non-European kind of words, mm-hmm. and roots? So that was really the moment 4 or 5 years ago I began this book when I was in New York, and I was idiotically in you know, Brooklyn, in the library in New York, public library, tried to go through some Webster's mm-hmm. archives and to look at his stress on certain American usage of the English language and then compare Dr. Johnson's. And then you would think, you know, I would produce thousands of pages of idiotic dictionary, you know, as you say, the form first or content first. But then they realize they should be somehow the similar thing or the same thing, uh-huh. if they could be, you know. I use dictionary as my way of narrative drive, mm-hmm. but as words I suggest on each page, you know, it should only contain no more than 2 pages long of the summary, and then my own personal kind of injection of the meaning of that word. Mm-hmm. But that word should also somehow link to the Eastern linguistic tradition, you know. As so, therefore, this book, I think a lot of perhaps journalists or reviewers, you know, without talking to me, they might find quite difficult, as you said, to pin down. You know, mm-hmm. what is it? We could call this, you know, a book of etymology of separation, uh-huh. or private dictionary. But for me, it's really the word radical here. Double meaning, you know, mm. radical in Latin is radice, the roots of words. Uh-huh. And then the radical in Chinese is exactly what we call the bushou, exactly the same meaning, the foundation, the roots of a building block of one Chinese ideogram. Mm-hmm. And from that place, you know, radical, exactly the same, the Eastern, the Western roots of the language.
Uh-huh. And that was the concept I was going to come on to, that idea of roots. And I find it fascinating that you say you went to Dr. Johnson's dictionary and you went to Webster's dictionary, because both of these were essentially the first attempt to formalize the language. So this written language that we have, and which to a certain extent works through these formalizations, you were drawn to both of these texts, which were the kind of the flags, in a sense, in the sand of, you know, the origins of these languages. And of course, dictionaries themselves are concerned with the origins of words, the etymology of words. What is it, do you think, that drew you to this idea of getting to the roots, whether it be the roots of a word, the roots of something in your life, or the roots of a culture, for example?
Mm. I mean, the idea of roots, radice or radical, you know, both metaphorical and physical. Mm. For example, I quoted quite a bit, you know, from D.H. Lawrence, mm-hmm. I think, when he was forced out mm-hmm. from England. You know, he was criticizing then the English culture, the divorce between the mind and the body. And I think use the quotation from D.H. Lawrence when Lady Chatterley's Lover was banned. Mm-hmm. And he said the loss of roots, you know, in English culture, the upside down, you know, the roots are up in the air, and the body, the branches are putting, you know, upside down. So therefore, we lost the touch with the body, the roots, the soil for the English culture.
Yeah.
And I thought about that. It's almost like, you know, we are intellectually completely uprooted, you know, because there's such a large kind of intellectual drive in our life, you know, with technology, with imagination, that we no longer know, you know, where our body belongs to, mm-hmm. and especially with mass immigration culture. Mm-hmm. I'm really one of the very typical cases, you know, from very agriculture, traditional Chinese landscape. Mm-hmm. You know, with my mother's side, they were tea farmers. Mm-hmm. And then my father's side, the fishermen. And I really grew up with this racket kind of culture, you know, with soil, with beach, and doing everything with hands to survive. And then suddenly, when I was 13, you know, come to London and then came to Europe. And then with this book, I was in New York, you know, try to find back this this kind of zigzag landscape, you know, try to disentangle or entangle myself back mm-hmm. into that agricultural landscape. So when you read a bit, you know, something about, you know, after 8 pages of the book, you know, there's a kind of lot of quotation about plants, uh-huh. right? And I think gardening plants, it was somehow, you know, funny, like take hold of the book. Mm. And that I think almost like my funny statement from those, you know, traditional dictionary, you know, they were into those really European original words, you know. And I remember this one concept, I think Voltaire's words in this book, you know, mm. in the end of the book, Voltaire said, you know, in those times, all we could care mm. is to look after our garden. Mm-hmm. So that's from Candide.
Yeah.
And you do use that quotation, you know, just to take the book into somewhere which we can root ourselves, you know, with mm-hmm. our linguistic identity and also with just memory.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, that's how maybe the publisher think, you know, this should be called as memoir. Mm-hmm. What should we call this book? I was asked.
Well, it's funny because we've been having this discussion at the bookshop of where to shelve it. And we haven't come to a conclusion yet.
Incredible.
Yeah. But that's what's one of the things that's exciting about it as well. It's not categorizable in a sense. I think there's two things from what you just said.
I would love to use that title, you know, on your podcast or a book cannot be categorized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it cannot be, you know, it would be just funny. I mean, it would be honor for uh-huh. me, you know.
It's almost like, I mean, you mentioned Borges a few times. And that sounds almost like a Borgesian concept of like the book that cannot find its home anywhere in the library. And you've written it.
Exactly. And I think it's amazing, you know, Borges' fascination with Chinese language. Mm-hmm. And as Kafka, they're all very, very fascinated with traditional Chinese culture, old Asian Chinese culture. And the quotation, that section about, you know, embalmed beast. Mm-hmm. And I think Borges was studying Chinese when he was 17.
Mm.
And he found his earliest encyclopedia from China.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then I went on the same kind of etymological journey. Like Borges did, you know, but just like, you know, hundreds of years later, try to locate that. Mm-hmm. And I found in my Chinese knowledge, it's called Arya. So mm-hmm. it's a collection of encyclopedic kind of reference book in ancient China, more than 3,000 mm-hmm. years old. But still, you can't locate back those weird translation, which Michel Foucault mm-hmm. re-referenced Borges. And I referenced Foucault uh-huh. in this book. You know, and I thought, this is a crazy book. who will read this book?
Well, that's why you need booksellers on side, you see, because we will go out and we'll hand sell it to our readers. I just want to come back to two concepts, picking up on what you were saying a moment ago. So this question of sort of the earth and getting back to the earth, and you use that term, I think, again from Lawrence, nostalgie de la boue, the nostalgia for the mud, for the soil. And there's two interesting concepts there. There's obviously the mud, but also this question of nostalgia. Now, last time we were in a room together was at Hay Festival, celebrating James Joyce's Ulysses. And of course, the nostos, the homecoming, is such a pivotal subject for Joyce. And I feel that it weighs equally heavily on your book, actually. There is this quest for understanding what home is and finding it when the original home is no longer available. Does that sound fair?
I mean, absolutely. I think it's almost healthy to say, as long as we recognize we have lost home forever, mm-hmm. there's no more physical home to be found or reestablished, mm-hmm. then we're healthy. The most dangerous thing is we still keep looking and mm-hmm. try to reclaim it physically,
mm-hmm.
and that's almost like those conflicts that are happening now, you know, with mass land grabbing, all that. And I guess, you know, for agriculture person like me, you know, immigrant from faraway place, you know, if I was, you know, persistently looking for that home, probably, you know, what I do, I mean, you know, it's different situation, like I will be having a land in Portugal, mm-hmm. you know, to have asked you there. It's, you know, almost like I'm a global peasant, you know, should I get a large piece of land somewhere mm-hmm. in the West in order to reclaim my lost identity? But I think this is idiotic kind of effort, you know, the attempt in vain, because that nostalgia is really a poetic sorrow. You mm-hmm. know, you could only claim in a poetic work rather than in a physical sense, you know. And I think once I saw that, then, you know, I am okay as an artist. But I still want to quote that D.H. Mm-hmm. Lawrence, you know, the Lady Chatterley has to go with his low man, you know, in their estate in D.H. Lawrence's novel. And then she was being blamed as nostalgia de la boue, mm-hmm. you know, at this desire to go to the mud to mm-hmm. find its own original power.
Yeah.
It is quite interesting. And I think that makes my book, you know, again, is weirdly, you know, it's almost like the attempt to return to this mm-hmm. metaphorical Jim Joyce sense of
yeah.
nostalgia in homecoming.
There's one potential source for this sense of home that you identify in the book. You write, for a woman, a child can be a home. And I think particularly you write for an immigrant, for somebody who is not connected to the, you know, by their history to the land in which they live, a child can be a rooting force as well. It can be, as you know, it's sort of almost like founding a new home. And yet one thing we find, and I guess this is maybe one of the central tensions in the book, is once you have established that home and once you have the child, the artist in you doesn't exactly feel restrained by it, but there's this definitely this kind of this tension between the two concepts, between the sort of the enforced domesticity of being a mother mm-hmm. and the way that keeps you often within a certain radius of a place, and the sort of the, I suppose, the freedom of the artistic quest you're on.
Absolutely. I think this female identity, you know, as a woman, as a mother, here, what is at stake when you are, you know, left out, leaving the house, leave this country, you have reestablished yourself as a new woman. It might be quite different from men, you know, leaving that house with, mm-hmm. where the child is still there. You know, I think it's something for me was this huge kind of disembodiment when I left Britain. I think that was a moment, you know, began a very personal part in this book, and I think I wrote about, you know, those sections. For example, I think once Floramania, you know, Floramania, the obsession with plants, with mm-hmm. with garden growing, and one is pollination, and another section is about avocado stone, and I remember eating one avocado on the plane, you know, try to get back to Britain from America, and then I kept that huge stone on the plane in that 8 hours flight. Mm-hmm. And I kept that huge stone. When I arrived in London, I planted that avocado stone, and it grew. And I wrote that in the book, you know, and I thought, my God, this is very powerful in a way, you know, the whether you call it, you know, it's a kind of witness of separation with my, you know, the attempt, the new kind of life, or is it kind of witness of the death of the new possibilities, mm-hmm. you know? And I think I treat it very subtly. I do think a lot of people had that kind of experience. They would know, mm-hmm. understand what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so part of that life, so you go to the United States, to New York for, well, it's supposed to be a longer period, I think, but we'll come on to the pandemic, which has kind of brings an abrupt end to your time in New York. And then there's this meeting with the person referred to as E during the book, and it's essentially the beginning of a love affair. And there's one moment where you write about falling in love. And I found this a very fascinating insight. You said, here is my thinking about falling in love. When we fall in love with someone, it can be seen as an autoerotic act. It's falling in love with the idea of a good self. I see the idealistic self in the desired person. That's how the person in love functions. And I wonder, concerning the story with E, Do you think a big part of the sort of the impetus, in a way, for that story was falling in love with the free version of yourself that you were discovering, or the freed, perhaps, version of yourself that you were rediscovering in New York?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I wondered how to write about the topic of autoerotism for women. Mm-hmm. I think for men, you know, it's, I think you can read so obviously, you know, from Rimbaud, from all these big authors, or, you know, especially in their youthful time. Mm-hmm. But how to write about it for women also, especially when you're not, you know, in a prime time, but the it's a strong kind of physical existence in your daily life. And I think for me, it's definitely something to do with autoerotic kind of connection with the other. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, it doesn't matter the opposition, you know, the person there. There I say object, you know, from woman's point of view, the man can be the object. It's really this self-realization from this painful incompleteness, right, as an individual, and in my case, as a woman.
Mm. And one of the reflections this gives rise to, and you've used the word already, and I'm going to probably to mangle it now, is this idea, this German word of the Lebenskünstler. Lebenskünstler, is that, yeah? So perhaps for our listeners who, perhaps like me, are not familiar with this concept, would you be able to give a little bit of an explanation about what it is?
I think in this book, I referred quite a few sections to Goethe's novel. Mm-hmm. Goethe's novel, it's the English title, one of the versions called The Elective Affinity. Mm-hmm. And it's experimental narrative about four person, and then, you know, a couple, man and woman, and another couple, man and woman, and then somehow become A, B, C, D. So the reorganization of A goes to C and B goes to D. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a crazy, strange novel. You know, it's like Goethe's mind thought experiment about the combination of the elements in human life. Attraction and distraction, could I say those words? Or repulsive energy when you reorganize the partnership. And also one concept from that book is the Lebenskünstler. So especially for women who doesn't create artwork or who doesn't become a political figure or you know, or someone not in a social place to claim her identity, then why not this woman's great Lebenskünstler, meaning someone live to create life as a piece of art. Mm-hmm. Right, so this is not talking about those, you know, body artists like the Japanese artist Yayoi Kusama I mentioned in the book. It's just to talk about a woman who doesn't create the supposed, the conventional artwork, but treat her own life as this incredible art project. You know, the way you cook, the way you have tea, the way you sleep, the way you grow plants, the way you deal with your neighbors. And I think this is so kind of overlooked historically, you know. The woman's identity is so not existent if a woman just live like a Lebenskünstler, you know. Yeah, and yet this concept is incredible male concept almost, you know. So in my section, I had to correct it to make a female version of that German word, you know. So, and in a way, you know, this word, the German word, could be the title for this book as well, you know. What does this book try to innovate in a way, you know, is by life is not about doing, you know, it's undoing, unthinking, right? It's on, you know, on debate. It's, you know, disentangle from this the heat of our social life.
Yeah.
It's completely undo, and then you become the true, this Lebenskünstler, you know, a person living for the life as a great art, right? So we are not, you know, entangled with capitalistic or political power struggle, all that stuff, you know. And I thought a lot about that. So that novel by Goethe was so much referenced. And also another quote, there's one section starts from the word X. Mm-hmm. And I thought about, you know, what is X? Because in Samuel Johnson, he said X doesn't exist in Anglo-Saxon word. You know, in his time, was it right?
Yeah.
Because it's you know, from Latin or Spanish, right? Mm-hmm. Starts from X as a name. And I also look the Webster's dictionary, you know, it doesn't exist. Then I thought about my own name in the Western way. It starts from X.
Of course.
Xiaolu. And then I thought about this incredible painting by surgeon, singer surgeon, the Madame X.
Yes.
And this beautiful, sexy, but dubious kind of portrait of unknown women.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about all this kind of strange identity, you know, as unknown, as X, as other, as women, you know, or as a living counselor, right? So they are connected together through this book. Yeah.
There's a kind of strange paradox, isn't there, with sort of identifying people who embodied this concept because they often don't leave a trace in a way. There's almost like the artist is a sort of a failed version of this because they have the, you know, they've channeled the art into their writing or into their painting. And so you go through a few sort of possibilities. You say like Walt Whitman, Colette, Marcel Duchamp, Neil Cassady. And I suspect perhaps of all of them, Neil Cassady might be the closest. And because he was obviously memorialized by Jack Kerouac rather than, I mean, he did write some things, but that wasn't his sort of, that wasn't his art in a way. And it also put me in mind of, and I think it's in the Henry Miller book, Sexus, where he talks about how essentially if he was living well, there would be no need for him to create art. There would be no need for him to write. And in fact, the fact that he does this is in some way a representation of his failure.
Absolutely.
Is that something you would agree with?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. It's almost like this book also, you know, I guess in China, if I wrote this book in Chinese, it would be put on the art critics section, you know, kind of... I mean, because in Chinese language, I wrote a few art critics books.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the first attempt I wrote in English, you know, and returned to my Chinese habit of the way how I wrote. It's really about, you know, the relation between art and a way individual. And I think it's always art is kind of this large missing part of the reality we haven't owned or possessed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very much, Jean-Paul Sartre said, you know, to live is to recount or to live for real.
Yeah.
And he had chosen when he was very young to recount.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost a fateful decision for him. If Sartre was a different man, you know, looked different or had a different child, he might choose to live rather than to recount. Then he wouldn't be the Sartre we know these days, right?
Yeah.
So, and I quoted in my book, I think Nietzsche's first lover, Lo Salome.
Mm-hmm.
And so this Germanic woman as this kind of inspiration, completely free spirit for Nietzsche, you know, she wouldn't kind of, you know, kind of go into that kind of marriage proposal, all this conventional idea of womanhood. And she lived completely her life. It's so unusual, you know, throughout her life. So I thought about those references. You know, they are the spirits for my book.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to just as a quick aside, this may be a stupid question and we can edit it out if there's not really an answer to it. But is there a sort of a mirror version of this book that could be written in Chinese? I'm just so curious because the book, as I said in the introduction, seems to sit between the Chinese language and the English language. And obviously a direct translation wouldn't perhaps work because so much of it is about explaining to English readers how the Chinese language works. But could you imagine a similar book written in the other sense?
I could imagine this book would be written in Chinese language. It would be, again, exactly what I call it radical, which the literal translation is bushou, meaning the roots, the partial foundation of one ideogram, a character, a word. So in Chinese language, it might work, but the reference in this book is this huge collection of Eastern, Western culture reference. So it does require a reader has sort of, you know, both kind of knowledge and both words. But then I think my book should be very typical, a kind of new generation who grew up exposed to both Eastern, Western, South, North culture that has this urgency to say, you know, where we are or can we just look at, you know, the inference, the realities we inhabited and say what life is rather than making this incredibly, you know, fabricated narrative about a one sealed traditional event, right? So again, you can say, you know, this is kind of, you know, a positive Derrida kind of experiment, you know, on what we are, you know, completely fragmented, but again, is this pieces together in a very solid way, you know. I don't want to say those words, but I do think we have authentic way, you know, formed together after, you know, 20th century, after the mass migration. Mm-hmm. The influence, the cultural reference in our life is so strangely, wonderfully, chaotically putting together. And I think the one, anyone who reads this book will say, my God, here we went back to Lao Tzu, to Tao Te Ching, and to Taoism, and then next page we refer back to Christianity, or you know, so you know, maybe you should actually live in this mm-hmm. kind of double or multiple dimensioned mm-hmm. world.
Yeah, and that's one of the concepts that comes up, is this idea, I think it's from Deleuze and Guattari, about the sort of the minor literature, which was admittedly a concept I'd heard but had never really understood before reading this book. But the sense I get of it, it's not the sense of minor as in insignificant, but sort of literature written from a sort of minority perspective within a larger language. And it really struck me as that sort of feels very much like the literature of our time, in a way. Like this is where the most interesting ideas, the most interesting writing is coming from, is people sort of like yourself, who's writing maybe not in their first language, or having migrated from one country, one continent to another. And it seems to sort of to break open our thought processes and our preconceived ideas in a way that perhaps somebody writing in a, let's say, in a major form in that language would not really be capable of.
Absolutely. And I think we do share, you and me, you know, our life, off-center life, you know, mm-hmm. you as kind of expat or, you know, non-native living mm-hmm. in France, you yeah, know, from yeah, Anglophone yeah. world, and the way you wrote, even though you write in Anglophone English, mm-hmm. but then the cultural reference, the style of narration is so away from the mainstream mm-hmm. Anglophone literature.
Right.
And I think this we share, you know, I mm-hmm. come from Chinese culture. I use this strange Anglophone kind of linguistic kind of narrative to write, but have this hybridity from the Chinese mm-hmm. language and the cultural background. So the way we enter this huge language, the English language, in such a strange in and out way, mm-hmm. right? And I really felt incredibly inspired by those lines which I quoted in the book, you know. And I think in his essay originally was referring to Kafka, you mm-hmm. know, writing in High German away from Czech.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but I think that is. You know, of course, perfect example at that time. Mm-hmm. But imagine, around Nigeria author writing in French, or Japanese author writing in German, you know, the Chinese author writing in strange English, you know. And I think that we as writer authors cutting through this huge language, mm-hmm. the Western dominant languages, mm-hmm. let's say, in such a strange way, and in my background is from one major language, Chinese, to another major language, mm. which is English. And I just look at my place in Anglophone literature. You know, I'm aware, you know, what I need to do. You know, if I still have some kind of little writer's ambition, mm. you know, my place linguistically and culturally, I do need to find my own roots, my radicals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So the final thing I'd like to talk about is this idea, and you use two words for it in the text, or two ways of describing a particular concept. So the concept of the vagrant. And so the vagrant in the sense of Rimbaud was a vagrant. And generally this term has quite negative connotations, but there's also the sense of it in ornithological bird-watching context, where it's a sort of a technical term about a bird that leaves a flock and then, crucially, has a capacity of rejoining the flock. And then right at the end of the book, you talk about this concept, this lovely phrase to ramble on, which, you know, you reference the Led Zeppelin song of the same title. And so I was wondering, to finish, might you be able to just reflect on this idea of vagrancy, of rambling, particularly, I guess, alongside that idea we talked about earlier of home? Like, can these two concepts exist side by side in one person?
Mm. I have to, I think, tie those big issues into a woman's journey. You know, mm. if a woman who refuse to be confined in a traditional society, you know, let alone a domestic life. Mm-hmm. What's her journey would it be? You know, also linguistically, culturally, she tried to trespass mm-hmm. or reestablish a kind of a chaotic forest with many paths going to lead her to somewhere would be, you know, calling that's her home. So I quote, that's why I think first I quote Mary Shelley's mother, mm-hmm. Mary Wollstonecraft, because she was this really pioneering mm-hmm. feminist from that time, you know, went along to the north, to Scandinavia, and to Italy, you know, her wild journey and very short life. And then again, come back to Mary Shelley's life, you know, it's such a kind of really wild, but almost fragile in a sense, because from that time, it was not sustainable for women artists. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I'm not putting myself on that map, but I felt like we are all somehow struggling to find this a certain wilderness and wildness in our female existence, because we express, mm-hmm. we express certain kind of wild things, you know, and then we physicalize and exercise those wild dreams. I think that is hugely dangerous for female experience, mm-hmm. especially when you have establish home and have children. Why it should be more dangerous than the male existence? Because our morality, our traditional society has such a weight mm-hmm. to judge a woman's existence. I guess, you know, with my book, I try to challenge or finding kind of different answers for that way of being, to say, you know, here are the paths we went through, you know, from this to that, from this pioneer to now ordinary beings, you know, what we have gone through linguistically, culturally, and this is the landscapes we are trespassing, you know, let's facing it. And mm-hmm. here's a dictionary for all these personal references. Mm-hmm.
That feels like a perfect place on which to leave it, Jalu. It's been such a pleasure today. Obviously, we have plenty of copies of Radical available at Shakespeare and Company. If you're not in Paris, you can pick one up from our website or from your local independent bookstore, wherever you may live. If you're quick, we have some signed copies in stock right now. All that remains for me to say is, Jalu, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Dan. Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare and Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Freiman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.